Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the only podcast that focuses on mental health while mixing in movies, music, books, sports, and pop culture. Here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
Hey, good morning, and welcome to Voices for Change 2.0.
Yeah, how's it going, strangers? How you doing? Thanks for joining us and tuning in today. We apologize for the hiatus, if you will, us being away. A lot of stuff that's been going on. And for those who are concerned, Haley is doing much better. Thank you. And for those who donated to our GoFundMe to help with her medical expenses, we are eternally grateful to you. Thank you for the outpouring of love and help. Words can't describe what it meant to us. So just thank you. You guys know how we feel about our little fur babies there, and this one more so than anything else. She's been our faithful companion for the last 17 years, and you wouldn't think it looking at her, you know.
No, definitely not.
But yeah.
She doesn't act like an old cat, so
no.
We're really blessed there. So, and I thank you guys too. We've had some struggles over the last few weeks, we're not going to lie.
Yeah.
You know, lots to deal with, and this is always a difficult time of the year for me to begin with. Once we start getting into Halloween talk, I start to just decay.
It's just, like a zombie, you will.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just knowing that the next steps are Christmas or Thanksgiving and Christmas are always a little bit overwhelming to me. More so now that my folks are both gone. So,
yeah,
it's just us.
Yeah. It's a little tough, you know, and, you know, last year we looked at the whole situation. Last year was the first year we didn't have Beck's dad, had passed before Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so it was our first year going through those holidays. And, probably right around this time of year, Beck said to me, what are we going to do? And I said, we're going to make our own traditions. And so now we look for our own traditions, our own things that we do to make the holiday ours. You know, we don't have kids, so can't shuttle our focus onto them. But we make it what we need to make it for us so that we can enjoy the holiday instead of making it depressing bummer of a situation. And I recommend that to anybody who's listening who struggles this time of year. You know, get out of your head and find different things to make this holiday your own, this whole holiday season your own. You know, I've gotten to the point where one of the local radio stations will play a whole bunch of Christmas music. Like, it seems like it starts November 1st, honestly. And I will force feed myself Christmas music. Yes, I know I'm a sick individual, but I'll do that to help get me kind of in the Christmas mood, you know, and it does help. You know, you feel a little bit happier and, you know, yeah, you kind of,
you do.
Well, I do. Yeah. You know, and yeah, it makes me wistful for, you know, when I was younger and, you know, spending the holidays with my family and, you know, with my dad being passed, and you know, we don't get to see my mom that much, but we do the best we can with it. And you know, I appreciate what I had, but I treasure what I have in front of me now. So that's my words to you.
Okay.
The end.
All right, thanks,
okay.
Babe.
Yeah.
So for today's show, we are chatting with someone that I really value as a mental health advocate. I have followed his podcast a little bit, and you know, he's got this really really cool show called You, Me, Empathy. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but we just are really grateful to have him with us on our first show back after our brief hiatus. So please welcome to the show, Mr. Noan Wells.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
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 Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, really.
Your microphone sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
I have a ATR 2100 Audio Technica mic hooked up to my little Xenix mixer. So I do it right over here.
Nicely done, sir. I actually have one of those mixers myself. The Behringer, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to use that in my band. Those are great little mixers.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, we're rocking a blue mic over here.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Blue Yeti.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know those. Can I just say that my heart goes out to you two? I'm a fur baby lover myself. I don't know the nuances of Haley's situation, but I could feel your struggle, your pain. And so my heart goes out to you, and I'm empathizing with that sentiment.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very, very much. It means a lot, you know. I don't know if you saw any of the pictures over that Beck posts from time to time, but yeah, she's our baby.
Our princess.
Yeah.
Please excuse me if you hear my teeth chattering. It's like 10 degrees in our bedroom right now, so.
Yeah, she's a little chilly here versus your nice, warm Southern California weather.
Yeah, sure. I apologize in advance for that.
I'm teasing.
I have so much shame.
He did, yeah, you did have to get up really early, and we do appreciate that. So thank you for that, having to get up at the crack of dawn on a Saturday when you could be sleeping.
Yeah.
So.
It's my pleasure.
So if you don't have any questions for us, we're just going to get the ball rolling.
Let's do it.
Cool.
All right.
Yay.
Well, we'll start off with the question that we most often ask our our guests, and that would be to tell us where your mental health journey begins.
Oh, boy. You know, I think if I'm looking in retrospect, I would say it began, you know, as a little boy, being very sensitive and being scared of my father, developing what I called my heart guard, basically a protective sort of security, survival measure to protect my heart and to protect the sensitive little boy that I was. I think I think that was the early on stuff. And then I think the more pivotal stuff or seminal moments started, you know, I think this is a common for a lot of us, but it started in my late teens and early 20s when I sort of was trying to mediate my parents' marriage. And that being something that wasn't happening, I couldn't control, of course, and it sort of broke me. And I started, at that point, I started, you know, depressed, anxiety, anorexia, and it led to sort of me almost dying. But I think all of that, the foundation of that is just being the sensitive boy who cares deeply about humans and, you know, maybe takes it a little too far.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, though. You know, I mean, I think we could all use a little more love and compassion in this world. And, you know, it's a drag that you felt the need at that age in your teens that you had to be the mediator between your parents. You know, that should never be a responsibility that falls on the child, you know.
Sure.
So sorry that, you know, you had to go through that. You know, it should have been the other way around. They should have been doting over you, you know.
I agree, and thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, you know, I completely get that with the, you know, especially when you're talking about how when you were younger and having to protect your heart and your feelings, it's tough, you know, because when you're real little, you know, you don't understand what's going on, and you know, you can't really, you don't know how to articulate it to anybody. So you just kind of shove those feelings down and, you know, protect yourself the best you can. I think you did a pretty good job, all things considered.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I remember being a young age and listening to my parents fight because, you know, parents fight. You know, there's nothing to be embarrassed of. You know, my parents especially were pretty good for a bout. But I actually had it set up where I could call my friend, my best friend. And my dad had worked out of the house, so he had a office in our family room, and he had a separate phone number. And I'd call her from the house line and ask her to call his business line. And she would just ring the phone, and they would have to break it up, and he'd have to go try and answer the phone, and she'd just hang up. But it was enough to get them to stop for a little while,
which is brilliant.
Yeah,
that is amazing. I love that so much.
Just a little coping mechanisms I created when I was a little kid. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I empathize with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe's right. You know, at that age, you don't have the capacity to understand what you're going through. You don't have the language to identify what you're going through. And kids need just so much love and compassion and understanding. And when there's not much of it, or when there's just a little bit of it, or there's maybe the opposite of it at times, it's challenging. You just kind of go, I mean, I, as someone who's an introvert also, you know, you go inward and, you know, you sort of stuff it down until you can figure out what it is, you know?
Right. Or you explode. That's
or
the
you
other
explode,
thing.
Yeah,
you know, and I don't say that facetiously. I completely mean that, you know. When I was younger, I would hold stuff in, and I remember distinctly being 11 or 12 years old and the doctor diagnosing me with an ulcer at the time, because how I would keep in my emotions, I wouldn't let them out. I wouldn't, you know, if I got angry, I'd stuff things down. And you know, after that, and Beck can back this up, you know, when I get angry, I get angry, and, you know, I'll let it out, but I'll have my little outburst, and then I'll cool off and be okay.
When he has his little outburst, I vacate the premises.
Yeah, you know, but I think, yeah, exactly, you know, but I think as I've gotten older, I've learned to cope better, and I've mellowed out. I know I've done that, you know, something that would have, you know, just sent me into a rage at 25. Now at 44, I laugh it off because there isn't much you can do about it, you know, just kind of take it in stride.
Yeah. We've both done a lot of growing the last few years.
Yeah. Yep. So,
you know, we're always growing. I think we have to. Yeah, totally.
Indeed. Indeed.
For sure.
Did you feel supported by family or friends, you know, when you were going through, you know, especially like in your teens and stuff, and things were starting to, you know, you're starting to get depressed and going through all the stuff that you were starting to go through?
I think the short answer is no. I would say that even at that point, I sort of associated my value or my strength in putting all of myself into others.
Mm-hmm.
which is you know, valiant, but it's also, as we know, you know, it's excluding the sort of self-care component of it. And I didn't know how to do that at that point. And right. So I was, at that point, I was with my mom, and she was living in a place where it was a bit more isolated, and I didn't really have any friends around. So it was a number of years where it was just kind of back and forth, where I would listen to my mom cry, and she'd cry on my shoulder. She'd talk about my dad, berate my dad, what have you. Then I would listen to my dad, and he would yell about my mom, and you know, and it was just a back and forth for a number of years until I just started kind of losing it, started not eating, started, you know, running 20 miles at a time. And then I, in my sophomore year of college, I went to study abroad in Wales, Swansea. And at that point I started really to lose it and started to go downhill pretty fast.
Mm.
So is that 19 to 20 year old area?
Yeah.
Everybody, virtually everyone that we've interviewed, everything sort of manifested at that age, and it goes the same for me. You know, I was 19 when I was diagnosed. So, yeah, it's, somebody needs to look into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think some studies need to be done.
I think there's something about identity at that time in our lives where we're sort of almost biologically trying to establish our identities. But, you know, depending on how our foundation is, depending on how we grow, we, you know, we may not have the tools yet. So we're trying to establish an identity. And for me, at least, I didn't have the emotional structure or tools to really support that, you know. And then it can go, you know, terrifying or bad or dark places if you don't have that emotional foundation.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that makes sense. You know, I mean, you think about it, you know, you have one mindset about yourself when you're in elementary school, and, you know, it starts to change when you get to junior high or middle school, whatever you call it. And then you have this mindset of who you are and who your friends are, who you fit in with in high school, whatever that may be. And then once you graduate, you're kind of out there like, well, now what, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, what you, I mean, some kids get it together early, like, well, I'm going to be this when I grow up, and they've got this whole thing figured out. I'm 44 and I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I did know at one point, and I've outgrown that. And, you know, so now, I think it's just a matter of finding happiness and peace, you know, and taking what comes as it stumbles into our lives.
Yeah,
totally.
So it's definitely not as common. You don't hear about it as often for men to report of dealing with anorexia. Was that something that you know that accompanied a lot of stigma? Were there difficulties with that? Did you struggle with, you know, telling people what was going on with you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that it was hard to come to terms with, I think, and part of it was, yeah, me being a man and dealing with that. I think, you know, I definitely got stigma, but I didn't, like, it was one of those things where I wanted people to know the pain I was experiencing, but I also, at least initially, didn't know how to talk about it. And so I got a lot of, like, go eat a sandwich, or like that sort of stigmatizing language toward me. I did get, you know, people you know, obviously, like, concerned with my health and worried about me. But I think even today, I think we still don't – we struggle with finding the words, finding the language, finding that sort of compassionate support for really a lot of mental health issue. But when I went to study abroad in Wales, I was already down about 40 pounds or so. Trigger warning for anyone who struggles with an eating disorder. But I was maybe 175 pounds. That's kind of like my normal weight. And I was about 145 or something when I went to Wales. And then I went downhill, and I started losing my hair. I would walk to the university, and, you know, everything felt like all of my bones felt like I needed, like my knees felt like I needed knee replacements. Like I said, my hair would fall out. I was always cold and I dropped down to 118 pounds. And
wow.
The doctor basically said, you know, your heart is going to stop if you don't do something. And that was sort of a wake up call for me. But it's so interesting, that time in my life. I think, looking back, it was a control thing. I think that I felt so out of control in the attempts at mediating my parents' marriage. I felt lost. I felt, confused about my identity. And I found control in what I put in my body. I also felt maybe a need to even show the world in a very visible, sort of grotesque way, my pain and the sort of repercussions of the experience that I had. Once that doctor said, like, hey, buddy, your heart's going to stop, I started getting better, and it took a long, long time. But, I definitely had stigmatizing sort of conversations with people who didn't understand and who maybe still don't understand. But I think, once I started UME Empathy and once I sort of started going to therapy and being able to really talk about that stuff, I've grown so much emotionally and grateful for it.
That's good. You know, and that's the thing. People say stuff, and I think at least to a degree it's lack of understanding, So they'll say something stupid like, go grab a sandwich or what have you, and they don't realize that it's not, I don't want to eat. It's you're dealing with stuff, and you're exhibiting what you're going through the only way that you found you could do it, and the thing that's crazy or interesting to me is that when you were describing your thought processes when you were battling your anorexia is very similar to and again, trigger warning, but it's very similar to what we've seen and heard from people that self-harm.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of the same thing. It's a matter of control. You're in pain emotionally, but you can't express it. So you're doing this to yourself physically as an expression of your emotional pain, I'm real happy that the doctor said, hey, you need to do something about this, and you were able to start turning things around and are doing better, because, it's terrifying, and people don't understand. They don't understand what people afflicted with these various mental illnesses, what we actually go through. They don't get it, and it's like they don't want to understand. And it's like, no, you need to understand, because I guarantee one of your loved ones is going through this right now.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think my perspective on the maybe not understanding things is, you know, people are scared. People are scared of these conversations. They're scared of the potentiality of their loved ones experiencing these things. And I get that. I totally empathize with that. But as you said, it just takes maybe a conversation here and there and just gradual sort of growth and understanding in those areas. And I think that's why these conversations that we're having now and the conversations that we have with our friends, like my aim in life is to have these conversations all the time with the hopes of that I would maybe perhaps change the conversation styles or conversation sort of MOs of just another person. So maybe that person can have sort of more vulnerable conversations with their friends and then hopefully the stigma, the fear, the ignorance can subside a bit, you know.
Right.
But I Joe, I appreciate the empathy and the sort of the experience, the relating my experience to people who have, you know, have had self-harm. I went through a period of that myself, and it's totally true. And
yeah.
I even, you know, another trigger warning here, but I even, you know, in the sort of throes of my depression and anorexia, I, you know, I had pretty intense suicidal ideation. I often would sit. It's a strange image. It's almost like a poetic image. I guess when you get to that moment, you think everything's poetry. But I would often sit in this tub, this bathtub, in the flat in Swansea, Wales, and I would look down at my body, frail and kind of disgusted by my body, and but the water would sort of, it was almost like a softening effect, and I would feel maybe a little less sort of self-hate toward myself. And but I would also, you know, I would sit in that bathtub and think about cutting and think about ending things, and I'm grateful I didn't. But yeah, I mean, the mental illness is a serious thing. I think it's we can all very quickly vacillate to those darker moments.
Yeah, it's not that hard to do either. You know, it takes one. There's a thing. Of all places to pull this from, and I apologize for the hokiness of this, but in the Batman comic books, there's a thing about one bad day, and all it takes is one bad day to push you over the edge. You know, that's what they say happened with the Joker. That's what happened with Batman, you know, and where you go from there is what it is, but it's this catalyzing moment, you know, where you finally reach this point and some, you know, you're standing on the precipice and someone gives you a shove. So at that point, we're going to take a break.
All right. Thanks for that, babe.
Yeah, no problem. It's what I do. I am the resident nerd. So, we're going to be listening to Tara Naomi with Help You Fly, and we'll see you guys on the other side of this.
I know how misery loves a company. Got a party gathered around you now. They come running from far and wide, but who's gonna help you fly? And they come calling when you're falling down. Someone always pick you up off the ground. Oh, nobody wanna see you cry, but who's gonna help you fly? Whoa, whoa. Where's the like a little town. People always gonna help you get by, but who's gonna help you fly? It's a messed up situation when I got the word to call on when the well runs dry. But I just wanna celebrate my life, wanna find someone to help me fly. Whoa, whoa.
Hey, welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. I'm Joe. She's Rebecca. Say hi, Rebecca.
Hello, Rebecca.
That's my baby. And in case you're just tuning in, we are currently speaking with Mr. Known Wells, the wonderful advocate and podcaster on the show You Meet Empathy.
So, hello.
Welcome back.
As our Canadian friends say, how's she going, eh? So you're covering up the questions.
I'm sorry.
Baby.
I'm terribly sorry.
I'm working here.
Okay, yes, dear. You're a little exuberant this morning. I think you need to take it down.
I'm excited that we're back doing the show, and I am excited about the guests that we're talking with, and I am excited for life. So
wow.
I am. I am in a good place.
That's good.
Yay.
I'm happy. Yay.
Maybe a little of that fairy dust will blow off onto me.
So Noan, when did you decide to become an advocate?
That's interesting. I think after sort of my dark periods in my late teens and early 20s, I guess I was around 22, 23 when I started therapy for the first time. And I think I was still healing at that time. I think I was still struggling. And I took maybe a few years off of therapy, and maybe 4 years ago, I started seeing a therapist that I'm seeing today. She's fantastic. And it was probably at that point I realized that, sort of looking at life with a more sort of compassionate, I was always sort of loving and compassionate, but I was I think I was just a bit, had just a bit more intent with it, looking at life with a bit more compassion and empathy and kindness, you know, is really the only way to do it. I think another component of it is I have a brother who has schizophrenia, and that has been a struggle for my family and something that I took on myself early on, you know, maybe, I guess, maybe 10 years ago or so. And that has been an important part of my own sort of mental health knowledge and learning journey as well, like getting to know how to interact with him and to be there for him and to love him and to care for him. And in turn, you know, I sort of was able to turn that inward on myself as well. And then I started Yumi Empathy it was less than a year ago, back in January. And Yumi Empathy is really all about embracing our vulnerabilities, accepting our feelings, recognizing that we're all valid, feely humans that deserve love, and to just create safe spaces for these conversations around mental health. And it's my favorite thing in the world.
it's funny because I don't know if you pick up on this, but I can hear it in your voice, man. I can hear the compassion and the kindness. You know, I heard it the second we talked with you before the show even started. I'm like, wow, this guy is just incredibly sweet and loving, and I can just, you project it.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, that's very sweet. I have goosebumps. So I thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
and it's a little bit creepy how our your life and my life kind of run
parallel
to each other, between the struggling with the anorexia and having a brother with schizophrenia. You know,
yeah.
I have one as well.
Oh, wow.
We kind of go back and forth between whether his issues are more focused from his closed head injury or schizophrenia. Mm. And, you know, in fact, he's struggling a lot right now, and he's refusing to take his medication, and it's getting real rough.
Yeah, he's going through some stuff right now, and you know it's hard because you want to help him, and in some ways you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's the heartbreaking thing about it. You know. So
yeah.
When you mentioned your brother, we kind of looked at each other and was like, hey.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, Becca. My heart goes out to you. I think that, yeah, it's so hard. I still have the urge to want to put all of myself into others. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's such a hard realization that we can't control it, and we can only do so much to help, because, you know, it is literally the worst thing to know that our loved ones are struggling.
Yeah.
So difficult.
Right. Exactly.
How do you two, I don't know, face that, manage that yourself, inwardly?
Well, that's a good question.
We've always kind of had the sort of take on everything that it's sort of us versus everybody. You know, we kind of use teamwork and stick together, and we make sure that we don't ever focus the stress or the, you know, the troubles, that we want to make sure we never turn on each other.
Yeah.
You know, and so we always know we have a safe place to be.
Exactly. You know, and it's like, you know, even going back to early on when we got married, you know, seeing what Beck was going through, because she wasn't as stable then as she is now. So seeing the pain that she was in, you know, it's a helpless feeling, you know, and
yeah,
you know, I've learned over the years that when she's having darker times, when she's going through more stuff, you know, I ask her, you know, is there anything I can do to help with the situation, to make it better, to make it easier on you, you know? And if there is, she'll tell me. And if there isn't,
I'll tell you.
She'll tell me, you know, and mm-hmm. and at that point, I'll make sure she knows, well, you know, whatever you need me for, in whatever capacity, I'm here, you know, and that's, I think, a safe haven for her, is knowing that she can rely on me no matter what, you know, and I kind of take pride in that, because, you know, she's my baby. So
yeah, that's beautiful. You know,
but, you know, as far as the outside world and dealing with, you know, loved ones that are going through stuff that aren't, the, you know, the either of us, you mentioned self-care earlier in the show. And mm-hmm. there is a component of self-care where you have to
step away.
Yeah, you know, you have to look at the situation and go, well, I can be there for you in this situation up to here, you know, and you set, you almost have, and it's hard, but you almost have to set this boundary, because if you don't, you know that you're going to fall down a rabbit hole right alongside your loved one, and you're not going to benefit them, and you're not going to benefit yourself, you know, so you have to know where your limits are as well. And it's difficult. It sucks, you know, but you have to, you know, for your own sanity.
Yeah.
You know, and I get it. Cause you want to be Superman. You want to be the hero. You want to save them. You want to save everyone that you care about and make sure that they're okay. And that, you know, nothing is wrong, and that we all can lead happy, healthy lives, you know, and sometimes the reality is just not that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the intent there, or the sort of the feeling that we need to come in and sort of be Superman and or Wonder Woman and save the day and sort of, you know, it, I think that's coming from a heart first place, but it's also coming from a place of maybe some ignorance and maybe some, you know, just misunderstanding. And I think just with time, you know, as you learn more about mental health and things like that, you know, it gets a little grayer. It, you know, it's a bit more nuanced. There's a thing I'll always remember early on in Yumi Empathy. My friend Katie Hilliard mentioned, she said, we have to give people the dignity of their own experiences. And I love that so much, and it will always live with me, because I think that she's right. Like, she's right. We need to give people the chance to live their own lives and the chance to struggle, the chance to bump up against things and to learn from those experiences. And we can be there as maybe guides at times and be there in love, but I think we also have to let them struggle and let them be as well, which is, you know, of course, which is so hard, but I don't know. I just home. Love that.
It hits home for me. My dad was older when I was born. He was 55 when I was born, and he was always very overprotective of me, you know, even
that's an understatement.
You shuddy. even into my 20s, even after we got married, he was, you know, on the phone almost every day and all this stuff. And, you know, I understood where he was coming from. I knew it was a place of love. I knew he didn't want to see me struggle or fail or be hurt. I got that. I understood that, you know. But looking back on it, it's like, you know, I wish he hadn't been so overprotective, because it hampered me a little bit, you know, especially after we got married. You know, it was a huge learning curve for me, you know, going from, you know, living at home and living with their rules and what they did and all this stuff to finding my way as an adult, you know. And gratefully, I have, at least I think I have. I don't know. Have I, babe?
Yep.
Okay. but, you know, yeah, there's that dignity of finding your own way and living your own life, you know. And we need to afford that to people we encounter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
So turning back to you, me, empathy here, what kind of guests do you feature on your show?
Really everyone. I think it's really, you know, I've friends, you know, other sort of mental health advocate folks like you guys. It really, I want to highlight the humanity and the giant hearts of people who have mental illness, people who do work in the mental health field. So, you know, I've had people who are compassion researchers or musicians who, you know, also have bipolar disorder and struggle with the sort of crazy artist stereotype, or, you know, people who've had anorexia, or really everyone. I feel like empathy is the sort of mechanism that will change the world, and that's the show's focus. And it's really about creating those empathy sort of fueled conversations with the hopes of changing one person at a time, a listener, and that listener may, you know, talk more openly about mental health or their struggles, or coming to terms with. I had a gal reach out to me, and this happens every so often, and it's just so, I feel so grateful for this. I had a gal, probably early 20s, reach out to me recently via Instagram, and she said, "Hey, I saw what you said about, you know, your medication, and I'm about to take Lexapro, and I'm scared. I'm scared about how it will impact me physically. I'm scared of how it will change my mind. I'm scared, you know." And I said, "Hey, I'm with you. We've all been there. I was there too. I'm still there. I'm worried about it all the time. But if we have the people in our lives who know we're maybe going through that experience and are scared about it, it will be great. It will be fine. And you'll get through it. You'll be okay. And if you're not okay, that's okay too." So it's really just about grounding ourselves in these empathy experiences and the sort of compassionate people around us.
Yeah.
You know, I was gonna ask you. I kind of posted about this on Twitter last night, but since you had mentioned that you have some experience with dealing with self-harm, this really bothered me. Really, really bothered me. We were watching a show last night, and one of the ladies on the show had a necklace that the charm was a replica of a razor blade. Mm-hmm. And when I posted this on Twitter, there were a lot of people that were like, you know, that's kind of an emo thing that we did 20 years ago or whatever, but, you know, this, she was a baker on a cooking show with this gaudy razor blade necklace. And I've really actually kind of found it disturbing. Like, I had a hard time watching her on this show. And I just wonder if you have any opinion about something like that, if you have an idea, if you've seen it, or if you have an idea as to what kind of message that they would be sending with a necklace like that.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. You know, I empathize with your take on that, and I think that is a sensitive topic for many of us. My take probably would be to say that you know, we don't know what it means for her, for her specifically. Maybe she uses a razor blade to cut a lot of boxes. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, I'm trying to get better at just allowing people to be and to go through, you know, giving them the dignity of their own experience and saying, hey, this charm, this, it could mean something to her specifically that's very, you know, very personal and very, very much part of her story. You know, with that said, you know, I think it is on her and important for her to also understand the potential impact of that on others like us. But, you know, my sort of first take would be to, like, hey, what's going on there? Like, ask her questions, sort of understand. But I don't know. I think that we never know what people are going through. And I think we can't know until we have conversations and be a little vulnerable and to, you know, to show a little kindness and all that, you know. But I get your side too, Becca. I totally understand. That could be triggering for others, and I'm sensitive to that as well.
Yeah,
I have, you know, I'm 5 years clean myself, but, you know, that doesn't mean I don't still have urges or thoughts or whatever. So I see your side of it as well. Your opposing side as well. I don't know, maybe opposing is too strong a word, but you get where I'm going.
Yeah, I empathize with both sides of it. And I still have those urges as well. So I relate to that as well. There's a lot of as wells in there. I apologize.
No problem.
You want me to read that?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll read it. You look like you're about to read it.
No, go for it.
Okay, I'll read it. So what advice do you have for someone struggling with the same issues that you've battled over the years?
It's a great question. I would say that be kind to yourself. Understand that what you're going through is yours, and that's a powerful thing, and it's an empowering thing at times, but it's also others as well, and other people have experienced it, and in your struggles, you know, it's okay to not be okay sometimes. You know, I think that there are ebbs and flows ahead of you. There will be peaks and valleys, and to understand that you will get through it. You've been there before, and you'll get through it again. And to create little pockets of empathy and love in your life, and create, you know, have conversations and look inward and surround yourself with people who will allow you to look inward. You know, surround yourself with like other feely humans who are mirrors into your own sort of mental health and journey and growth and learning about your own struggles and your own brights and darks. And just show compassion for yourself. And those are my advice tips.
Okay.
I think it's good advice.
Absolutely.
Because we're getting really close to the end of the show here, Non. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, people can listen to You, Me, Empathy on Apple Podcasts, on Google, Spotify, Stitcher, all the places. You just search You, Me, Empathy. You can go to youmeempathy.com or my website, knownwells.com, knownwells.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at You, Me, Empathy. We also have a little private Facebook group that is a collection of just really great, awesome, safe, wonderful humans. That's at facebook.com/groups/YumiEmpathy. But yeah, search YumiEmpathy, you'll find all the things.
Cool.
All the stuffs.
Awesome. Well, we got to wrap it up. Before I let you go, I'm putting this out there to the people. This has absolutely nothing to do with the show.
Oh, awesome.
But I feel it needs to be said as time runs out for us. 11 days. I think it's 11 days. Get out and vote. Enough said.
Indeed. Yeah.
You know, whatever you believe, get out and vote. Needs to happen. Okay, off my soapbox. All right, so we are going to end the show with Baby Blue Sky by Nick Haywood. So, Known, stick around online here. And everybody else, we will catch you next week. We can't wait to talk with you all again. Thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for tuning in. Bye. Baby blue.